act in those days was the extent to which authority was able to conceal the president's true physical and mental condition from the public. But once again there was the illusion or simulacrum of being consulted. This was a hoax, and those who fall for hoaxes deserve the name of dupes. My dear friend Ian McEwan, in his novel The Child in Time, describes a man so demoralized by tragedy and loss that he is reduced to gaping at daytime TV game shows. Seeing his fellow creatures so eager to humiliate and embarrass themselves, he evolves a name for watching the proceedings and calls it the Democrats' pornography. Let us then agree to judge crowds as we would individuals, and to employ no standard of criticism that we would not allow to be directed at ourselves. In the age of Reagan, by the way, liberals and Democrats were more promiscuous than they have been since in suggesting that the people could be, or actually were, being fooled by a prestidigitator and a smooth PR machine. Milton Friedman might be wrong about sweatshops and free market opportunities, but he was not wrong to state that one man plus a correct opinion outvotes a majority. Pyotr Kropotkin might have been rather a rarefied anarchist, but he had a point when he said that if only one man has the truth, that's enough. Science proceeds by the same moral yardstick. A Marie Curie, experimenting on herself, is exceptional, of course, but an individual researcher with a set of properly tested theses or experiments can, and sometimes will, confound either a set of established experts or an unbelieving crowd. We owe a great deal to the apparent elitists, such as Machiavelli or Houdini, who by studying arcane information and practice, and then by making their findings public, contributed to demystification. One is sometimes asked by what right one presumes to offer judgment. Quo warranto is a very old and very justified question. But the right and warrant of an individual critic does not need to be demonstrated in the same way as that of a holder of power. It is, in most ways, its own justification. That is why so many irritating dissidents have been described by their enemies as self-appointed. Once again, you see, the surreptitious suggestion of elitism and arrogance. Self-appointed suits me fine. Nobody asked me to do this, and it would not be the same thing I do if they had asked me. I can't be fired any more than I can be promoted. I am happy in the ranks of the self-employed. If I am stupid or on poor form, nobody suffers but me. To the question, "Who do you think you are?" I can return the calm response, "Who wants to know?" One last straddle of my high horse. Then a beast which, as Gore Vidal once said, one must keep tethered conveniently within reach. I offered to tell you in another time and place about my relations with old Karl Marx, and I notice you have not yet taken me up on it. But I've always found it both fascinating and distressing that one of his best-known sayings is not one of his sayings at all. He did not say, and more to the point, he did not believe, that religion was the opium of the people. What he did say, in his contribution to the critique of Hegel's philosophy of right, was this: "Religious distress is at the same time the expression of real distress and the protest against real distress. Religion is the sign of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, just as it is the spirit of a spiritless situation. It is the opium of the people. The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is required for their real happiness. The demand to give up the illusions about its condition is the demand to give up a condition that needs illusions. The criticism of religion is therefore, in embryo, the criticism of the veil of woe, the halo of which is religion. Criticism has plucked the imaginary flowers from the chain, not so that man will wear the chain without any fantasy or consolation, but so that he will shake off the chain and cull the living flower." you will notice the difference between these rather splendidly nuanced sentences and their consistent, unvarying, one-sided vulgarization. They sum up what I most wish to convey to you in our argument about superiority. One must have the nerve to assert that while people are entitled to their illusions, they are not entitled to a limitless enjoyment of them, and they are not entitled to impose them upon others. Allow a friend to believe in a bogus prospectus or a false promise, and you cease, after a short while, to be a friend at all. How dare you intervene? As well ask, how dare you not? Are you so sure you know better? Ask yourself this question 1,000 times, but if you are sure, have the confidence and dignity to say so. Remember that saying nothing is also a decision, and that the relativists and the non-judgmental have made up their minds just as much, if not as firmly. This is simply another way of reminding you that if you decide to pass judgments and make criticisms and take forward positions, you both can and should expect a few hearings to convene on yourself. A welcome prospect, I trust. It certainly helps prevent the art and science of disputation from dying out amongst us. Chapter 13. The question you ask, what to read and whom to study, is one that I receive quite often. It ought to be an easy inquiry to answer, but it isn't, and this is for a series of reasons. The first and most obvious is that you should not look for arguments from authority. You must have noticed that I make liberal use of extracts and quotations, not just to show off my reading, but also to lighten my text and make use of those who can express my thoughts better than I am able to. So I am not immune from the weakness against which I am counselling you. I do have some sources of inspiration to which I recur, but it would not always be clear why they have come to mean what they do to me. Then there is the question of mood. The oppositional and critical mind need not always be one of engagement and principle. It has to deal with a considerable quantity of discouragement, and there are days, even years, when Diogenes has much more appeal than Wilde. I can think of two great authors from the great tradition of East European descent, Czesław Miłosz and Milan Kundera, who profited greatly from cultivating the uses of pessimism. In The Captive Mind, Miłosz wrote of the Baltic states, which included his ancestral and beloved Lithuania, as if they had been erased as completely by Stalinism as the American Indians had been extirpated by the successive European conquests. In a number of essays, most notably in the introduction to his novel The Book of Laughter and Forgetting, Kundera used the same tone of voice to describe the Russification of Czechoslovakia and other nations in what used to be called Mitteleuropa. He thought of the awful status quo as permanent and irrevocable. As it happens, I was able to differ with both of them, Miłosz in person and Kundera in print, and in time everybody lived to see the survival and renaissance of these cultures. But I did not, I hope, misunderstand the essential stoicism that was present in their work. There were times when the cause seemed hopeless, and yet they would not give it up. One way of facing this impossible position was to be as grim as possible and to treat all hopes as illusions. For those facing a long haul and a series of defeats, pessimism can be an ally. Apart from anything else, as some American Indians have also discovered, the presentation of the bleakest and starkest possible picture can have the paradoxical effect of mobilizing the emotions and the intellect. I have never myself been in a situation of apparently hopeless oppression, or had to try and recruit the personal courage to resist such a state of affairs. But from observing those who have, I conclude that the moment of near despair is quite often the moment that precedes courage rather than resignation. In a sense, with the back to the wall and no exit but death or acceptance, the options narrow to one. There can even be something liberating in this realization. Here I stand, I can do no other. I don't especially recommend Martin Luther. another of those types who resolve the irresoluble by deciding that they have been issued divine orders, but there is a reason why his phrasing is remembered. Noam Chomsky, a most distinguished intellectual and moral dissident, once wrote that the old motto about speaking truth to power is overrated. Power, as he points out, quite probably knows the truth already and is mainly interested in suppressing or limiting or distorting it. We would therefore do better to try to instruct the powerless. I'm not sure that there is a real difference in this distinction. Ruthless and arrogant though power can appear, it is only ever held by mere mammals who excrete and yearn and who suffer from insomnia and insecurity. These mammals are also necessarily vain in the extreme and often wish to be liked almost as much as they desire to be feared. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, one of the moral titans of our time, decided to write his nation's hidden history and was reviled, imprisoned, and deported for his pains. By the summer of 1987, however, the Soviet authorities had decided to cancel the existing history curriculum in state schools and not to resume it until new books could be produced. Solzhenitsyn could, I am convinced, have gone to his grave quite content without this vindication, which he never expected. He had already done what he set out to do. Yet history determined that he would enlighten not just his readers, but also a significant number of his former jailers. This doesn't make up for the numberless educated Russians who died wretchedly without being able to touch either an audience or the authorities, but then again, and in a fashion, it does at least help make up for it. In a very fine and moving poem about history and what it has done to those who believe in it, Peter Porter wrote, "History. Friedrich Kutsky, known as Mac, a lawyer's son who worked with Russian military intelligence and sent them warning England wouldn't fight over Czechoslovakia, was pushed off a grain freighter in Lake Superior by an NKVD man disguised as an elevator mechanic. Manfred Lohenfertz, Tom to their circle of university Marxist, helped organize the destruction of the PUM in Barcelona. Orwell had heard of, but never met him, and was himself arrested in Moscow 3 weeks after Catalonia surrendered. He is presumed to have died in prison. Frank Marshall, called the Englander because of his unlikely name, went straight to Comintern headquarters and survived the show trials of 36 and 37, only to disappear from his flat on the evening of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. His name is mentioned often in the few authentic papers which survived from Yezhov's office. The Szymanowski brothers, Andrew and Jerzy, led a Soviet expedition to Zemia and authenticated the reports of nickel deposits. Both were murdered when their boat was strafed by an unknown plane on an expedition in Bering Strait. The MVD uses more than ice picks, was said in Moscow in 1940. Lastly, Willy Marx, alias Oscar Odin, old granddad to the group, jumped in front of a Viennese tram the day before the Anschluss, with plans for Hitler's assassination in his shoes. No one knows which party organization ordered his death. 6 middle-class boys from a racially mixed Galician town, 3 of them Jews, and only 1 with a widow at a New England college. Their story will not be told. One of the finest moments in our history occurred when Nelson Mandela was visited by the authorities who had kept him in confinement for a quarter of a century. They had been shaken by international condemnation and also by a general rising of the oppressed. The name of Mandela, which was supposed to have been buried by a long and harsh immurement, was on every lip. "All right," they nervously said to him, "you can go now. You're a free man." His reply was, "I am not leaving. You do not have the power to release me, least of all to release me to gratify yourselves. I shall not leave this cell until I hear that everybody else has been released, and that all the laws of the tyranny have been stricken from the books." At that moment, it was clear who held the keys. Up until that moment, Every sort of pseudo-diplomatic compromise had been proposed to allow the racist usurpers to keep at least some part of their spoil and to save some part of their face. One of the great pleasures of my life, and one of the privileges of advancing age, has been that of revisiting people who I first met or knew as political prisoners or exiles or refugees. I first met Thabo Mbeki, now the president of South Africa, sitting on the floor at a scruffy radical party in London. Actually, he wasn't scruffy at all, in the early 1970s. His father was serving a life sentence back home, and he was living for two. I first met Kim Dae-jung, now the president of South Korea and a Nobel laureate for peace, when he was living in exile in Virginia, under the disapproval of the Reagan administration. He had survived one attempt by the South Korean junta to kill him and another attempt to kidnap him, this for the temerity of coming a close second in an election, and was in the process of deciding to go home and risk his life again. When he did go, I went with him on his plane and am still proud of the fact that I was with him when he was rearrested. A Czech exile friend of mine became his country's foreign minister. So did a Zimbabwean with whom I had once helped organize a protest meeting in Oxford. One of the women at that event also became the Speaker of the South African Parliament a quarter century later. Adam Michnik, a witty Polish dissident who was running rings around the Stalinist censors when I met him in 1975, now helps edit one of Warsaw's major newspapers. In Greece and Spain and Portugal, all of which were NATO-supported dictatorships while I was growing up, I interviewed men and women in hiding or on the run who subsequently became ministers, party leaders, diplomats, public intellectuals. My Chilean friend, Ariel Dorfman, who I first embraced after he read his defiant poems outside the Chilean embassy in Washington, was 14 years later the guest of honour at a reception, which I also attended, at that same embassy. There's no thrill quite like this, no satisfaction to match it. And I think I can honestly say that none of these comrades has, as so often happened in history, become in their turn a censor, a policeman, a jailer, or a demagogue. There is no iron law that proves Simone Weil's famously pessimistic aphorism which defined la justice as cette fugitive du camp des vainqueurs. Or perhaps I can't quite, or should not quite, say that. George Fernandez, the brave railwayman's union leader and head of the Indian Socialist Party, who survived beating and imprisonment during Indira Gandhi's years of emergency rule, became defence minister in a Hindu sectarian government and one of the advocates of India's calamitous nuclear policy. So one must be on one's guard. Thabo Mbeki made some stupid remarks about AIDS when he became president. Nelson Mandela made a speech in which he defended the vile Daniel Arap Moi of Kenya as a victim of colonialist propaganda. Alexander Solzhenitsyn went back to Moscow and became the host of a crackpot conservative TV show. Vaclav Havel, when I had lunch with him at the foot of the absurd and forbidding Prague Castle that he'd wrested from the Kafka communists, was embarrassed by any of my questions about the treatment of the gypsies. But there is comfort in this, too, if you look at it in the right way. Dr. Martin Luther King plagiarized his doctoral thesis and spent his last night on earth in some pretty rough fornication. It's hard to blame him for the latter. He lived with the imminence of death, and Rilke wasn't the first or last to discern that Eros is the best way yet devised of warding off Thanatos. As to the former, his most memorable speech was an improvised riff of excerpts and quotations, achieving a brilliant synthesis. I like the fact that he had feet of clay and a digestive tract and reproductive organs. All human achievement must also be accomplished by mammals, and this realization, interestingly negated by sexless plaster saints and representations of angels, puts us on a useful spot. It strongly suggests that anyone could do what the heroes have done. Our current culture, with its stupid emphasis on the role model, offers as examples the lives of superstars and princesses and other pseudo-ethereal beings whose lives, fortunately, I think, cannot by definition be emulated. I offer you two anecdotal examples, one of which I have tried myself before various large audiences in America. Ask in mixed company if anyone can name the last American to win the Nobel Prize for Peace. Nobel Awards are well reported here, especially in this category. You will find that nobody can do it. The answer is Jody Williams on behalf of the International Campaign to Ban Landmines in 1997. But see if you can find anyone who doesn't know that Princess Diana once did a photo op near a minefield. Our standard for these things is subject to its own Gresham's Law. Not only does it recognize the bogus, but it overlooks and excludes the genuine. The fish rots from the head in such matters. President Clinton sent his wife to the princess's funeral, but did not give the customary presidential call of congratulation to Miss Williams, who had criticized him in public for withholding his superpower signature from the Landmines Treaty. My friend Peter Schneider, the great novelistic chronicler of Berlin life, once researched and wrote a true story about a wartime episode. It involved the sheltering of those Berlin Jews who had violated the Nazi race laws by marrying Aryans. Some hundreds of these people were saved in an informal arrangement whereby some thousands of ordinary Berliners provided a bed for the night here, a ration book there. Peter thought that the publication of this account would be well received. There is always a market for stories about decent Germans. Instead, the reaction was a surly one. It took him some time to realize that by describing the brave and generous but low-level and unheroic conduct of so many citizens, he had undermined the moral alibi of many thousands more, whose long-standing excuse for their own inaction had been that under such terror no gesture of resistance had been possible. This depressing discovery need not blind us to the true moral, which is that everybody can do something, and that the role of dissident is not, and should not be, a claim of membership in a communion of saints. In other words, the more fallible the mammal, the truer the example. This sometimes cheers me up. Chapter 14. In Joseph Heller's Catch-22, which I hope and trust you have read at least once, there is the following exchange between the anti-hero Yossarian and the mind of military authority. Major Danby replied indulgently with a superior smile, "But, Yossarian, what if everyone felt that way?" "Then I'd certainly be a damned fool to feel any other way, wouldn't I?" When I first read that, I was much more at the mercy of schoolmasters and clergymen than I am now, and more in need of defensive ripostes to their dreary objections about setting a precedent or setting an example. Heller cut straight through all that with his absurdly subversive dialectic. Of course, if the oddballs and doubters were in a majority, they wouldn't be oddballs and doubters. And, of course, one never has to worry about there being a surplus of such people. Those who need or want to think for themselves will always be a minority. The human race may be inherently individualistic and even narcissistic, but in the mass it is quite easy to control. People have a need for reassurance and belonging. This contrast sometimes discovers itself under pressure. Consider two classically dissident and quite celebrated remarks by Albert Camus and E.M. Forster. Faced with an unjust colonial war in his native Algeria, where the insurgents would detonate random bombs that might as easily kill his aged mama as they might an occupying soldier, Camus observed that if compelled to choose between justice and his mother, he might well have to pick his mother. While Forster said that, given a choice between betraying his country or betraying his friends, he hoped he would be courageous enough to betray his country. Both of these sayings need their context. Forster wrote at a time when the phrase king and country was a synonym for fatuous jingoism, but you notice that in both instances the resort is not to lone defiance, but to another form of loyalty and adherence, in one case family values, and in the other the claim of the coterie. There is an important paradox at work here. Of those who are drawn into oppositional activity or mentality, it can often be observed that they are rebellious or independent types. Yet the best of them are actuated by concern for others and for causes and movements larger than themselves. Throughout the late 19th century and much of the 20th, many of the great Promethean individualists were men and women convinced of the rationality and justice of socialism. I'm thinking of moral and intellectual figures of the status of Antonio Gramsci, Karl Liebknecht, Jean Jaurès, Dmitri Tuchevik, James Connolly, Eugene Debs, and others. If you don't know of their lives and their work, you are the poorer for it. For most of my life, I considered myself a modest combatant in that cause, and I'm phrasing it like that for two reasons. The first of which is that I've been compelled to recognize that its day is quite possibly done. The second reason, more to the immediate point here, is that such an attachment was supposed to teach you to subordinate yourself to the greater good. This isn't an absolute contradiction by any means. The enemies of socialism never cease to sneer about its supposed attachment to regimentation and uniformity, whereas its real history is full of great moments when it actually broke open the barracks system of factories and slums, places where humans actually were treated like machines, to say nothing of its opposition to militarism and imperialism, two other features of the old world which involved regimenting and conscripting people while using them as property or as subjects in grand experiments. The socialist movement enabled universal suffrage, the imposition of limits upon exploitation, and the independence of colonial and subject populations. Where it succeeded, one can be proud of it. Where it failed, as in the attempt to stop the First World War and later to arrest the growth of fascism, one can honourably regret its failure. However, everybody knows the other list of names and dates and places which, though it isn't usually put like this, mark the degeneration of the First and Second Internationals into the Third. And some romantics and dogmatists, I can, if you like, be included in either definition, even know about the relationship of all this to the Fourth. Another book would be needful here. For the present, let's say that there's a whole hidden list of distinguished names, from Andrew Nin to Victor Serge to C.L.R. James, representing a lost generation of people whose dissent and resistance was largely conducted within, and even against, the left, as it was generally understood. They don't teach you this in school either, but the best writing of George Orwell and of Leon Trotsky is only intelligible as a part of this occluded tradition. And these same people, who would not surrender the principles that attracted them to the struggle in the first place, were obliterated and defamed as mere posturing individuals who furthermore dared to oppose themselves to history. Never mind history for now. To the extent that it is a subjective force at all, it has dealt very unkindly with their persecutors and executioners. The point to keep in mind is that when it came to it, these heroes had no stronger moral compass than their Dark Age predecessors, and were forced to rely as much on their own consciences, if not indeed more, as on any historical materialist canon. The essential element of historical materialism as applied to ethical and social matters was, and actually still is, this. It demonstrated how much unhappiness and injustice and irrationality was man-made. Once the fog of supposedly God-given conditions had been dispelled, the decision to tolerate such conditions was exactly that, a decision. The West, at least, has happily never recovered from this discovery. You would be astounded if you looked up the books and commentaries of only a century ago and saw what was taken for granted before the Marxist eruption. Fatalism and piety were the least of it. This was cynicism allied to utilitarianism. Don't let yourself forget it, but try and profit also from the hard experience of those who contested the old conditions, and, in a word or phrase, don't allow your thinking to be done for you by any party or faction, however high-minded. Distrust any speaker who talks confidently about we or speaks in the name of us. Distrust yourself if you hear these tones creeping into your own style. The search for security and majority is not always the same as solidarity. It can be another name for consensus and tyranny and tribalism. Never forget that even if there are masses to be invoked or the people to be praised, they and it must, by definition, be composed of individuals. Stay on good terms with your inner Yozarian. Several letters ago, I promised you a few words on the name Radical. Again slightly worn with use, it has a fine pedigree. The great Thomas Paine spoke of laying the axe to the root, and the essence of the radical definition is that it has its roots, so to speak, in the word root. Paine is an excellent illustration of this in one way. He saw that the root cause of distress in the 13 colonies was the Hanoverian monarchy, and at a time when most of the future American leadership was still monarchist and in favour of maintaining the British connection, argued strenuously for independence. On the other hand, not my favourite expression, except when used as it was as the title of Fay Wray's autobiography, his engagement with the French Revolution taught him the dangers of fanaticism and fanatics and all those who were sure that they possessed the truth and the right to impose same. In fact, the noblest verdict on Paine is that he wanted the French Revolution to be more temperate and humane, and the American Revolution, by abolishing slavery and being decent to the Indians, to be more thoroughgoing and profound. But in some ways, obscured by his combat with Burke, this makes him more of a conservative figure. He was certainly a lifelong opponent of big government, and not just in its monarchic and religious forms. Burke, in turn, though identified with the Tory and royal interest, was a very potent advocate for the rights of the American colonies, for the Bengalis robbed and bullied by the East India Company, and for his fellow Irishmen. The image of counter-revolutionaries concealed in the ranks of the revolution is, from numberless purges and show trials, a familiar one to us. But many is the honourable, radical, and revolutionary who may be found in the camp of the apparent counter-revolution. And the radical conservative is not a contradiction in terms. When I was young, I was consumed by the opposition to the Vietnam War, and still wish that I could claim to have done more to help the movement against it. In my university generation, there were many young Americans who agonized about the military draft. I was involved in assisting their resistance, and I know for a fact that it is completely slanderous to say that they worried chiefly about the wholeness of their own skins. Well, almost completely slanderous. One of the young Americans of my cohort was the self-seeking dodger Bill Clinton. The point about the draft, as it seemed to many, was that it was theoretically universal, and thus anyone who avoided or evaded it was, in effect, condemning someone else to go instead. This consideration operated very powerfully on those who were more fortunately placed, since their opposition to the war was of a piece with their support for the civil rights movement and the war on poverty. In effect, their consciences had been collectivized by society, though that was not at all the way we would have phrased it at the time. I thought then, and I think now, that those who resisted, whether by burning their draft cards, or going to jail, or going into exile, were absolutely right. There is an obligation, if your own government is engaged in an unjust and deceitful war, to oppose it and to obstruct it and to take the side of the victims. However, and I did not appreciate this until rather later, the draft was abolished because of the arguments of some people who weren't even that much opposed to the war. President Nixon set up a commission to examine the subject, on which sat Professor Milton Friedman, the celebrated author of Capitalism and Freedom, and Alan Greenspan, later celebrated in his turn as chairman of the Federal Reserve, but then best known as an acolyte of the ultra-libertarian Ayn Rand. Between them, these two men persuaded the other members of the commission that the draft was an unconscionable extension of state power, a form of taxation without representation, and a species of, freedman's term for it, slavery. So that while I and others were battling in the streets with the red flag and the flag of the NLF, the apostles of the free market were pressing our demands in the inner sanctum. The irony is probably at the expense of both of us. I draw your attention to it because there are still liberals and social democrats who regard compulsory military conscription as a form of social program, good for the soul and good for levelling and mixing and social engineering. Thus, in order to be a radical, one must be open to the possibility that one's own core assumptions are misconceived. I have not, since you ask, abandoned all the tenets of the left. I still find that the materialist conception of history has not been surpassed as a means of analysing matters. I still think that there are opposing class interests. I still think that monopoly capitalism can and should be distinguished from the free market, and that it has certain fatal tendencies in both the short and long term. But I have learned a good deal from the libertarian critique of this world view, and along with this has come a respect for those who upheld that critique when almost all the reigning assumptions were statist. I mentioned earlier my friend Adam Michnik, the Polish dissident who I met in the mid-1970s. He was not on the political right, as were so many Polish anti-communists, and he indeed had Trotskyist friends, which is how I met him, as well as contacts with the more conventional European left. However, he made a remark which over time was to change my life. The crucial distinction between systems, he said, was no longer ideological. The main political difference was between those who did and those who did not think that the citizen could or should be the property of the state. This had a nice echo of Thomas Paine's attack on slavery, "Man has no property in man," and it matched my own rejection of the thermonuclear national security state, which regards its subjects as disposable. If you want to pursue truly radical conclusions, I'd recommend that you follow the path indicated by Adam's incisive remark. He easily outlived the Leviathan that dwarfed his little group of critics at the time. With effort, perhaps, we could all be so lucky. P.S. A note on language. Be even more suspicious than I was just telling you to be of all those who employ the term we or us without your permission. This is another form of surreptitious conscription, designed to suggest that we are all agreed on our interests and identity. Populist authoritarians try to slip it past you. So do some kinds of literary critics. Our sensibilities are engaged. Always ask who this we is. As often as not, it's an attempt to smuggle tribalism through the customs. An absurd but sinister figure named Ron Molana Karenga, the man who gave us Ebonics and Kwanzaa and much folkloric nationalist piffle, once ran a political cult called Us. Its slogan, oddly catchy as well as illiterate, was, "Wherever Us is, we are." It turned out to be covertly financed by the FBI, though that's not the whole point of the story. Joseph Heller knew how the need to belong and the need for security can make people accept lethal and stupid conditions and then act as if they had imposed them on themselves. Chapter 15. Well, no, I don't think that the solidarity of belonging is much of a prize. I appreciate that it can bestow some pride, and that it can lead to mutual aid and even brother and sisterhood, but it has too many suffocating qualities, and many, if not most, of the benefits can be acquired in other ways. That's relatively easy for me to say, as you point out. After all, to have been born in England and to be brought up in its educated class is to have acquired certain securities as a kind of birthright. However, as was once so well said, what do they know of England? Who only England know? This applies with the relevant alteration to any country or culture. I want to urge you very strongly to travel as much as you can and to evolve yourself as an internationalist. It's as important a part of your education as a radical as the reading of any book. In the years of my upbringing, before I left for America at the age of about 30, Britain was making the transition from being a homogeneous and colonial society to becoming a multicultural and post-colonial one. I came of a naval and military family with a long tradition of service to the Empire. My first conscious memory is of crossing the Grand Harbour at Valletta by ferry at a time when Malta was still a British colony. As I grew older, part of the background noise was supplied by the collapse of British imperial arrangements in the Suez Canal, Cyprus, Aden, and Africa. This noise amplified through the growls of resentment I heard from being brought up in and around British naval bases. My grandfather had served in India in the First World War. My father had been posted in British overseas possessions as far distant as the coastal enclaves of China, the Cape of Good Hope, and the Falkland Islands. When I got married in Cyprus in 1981, he revisited the island for the first time since helping to put down a revolt there a half-century earlier. A regular occurrence was the arrival of mail from our uncles and aunts and cousins in South Africa, who sometimes came to visit and always seemed vaguely defensive. I won't say that I was brought up to think or hear anything ugly. My parents were too intelligent to be encumbered by prejudice, but the prevailing attitude to foreigners was of the "watch out for your wallet, don't drink the water" style, and this attitude was reinforced by the British gutter press as well as by many politicians. When I started travelling in earnest in my 20s, often to countries that had once been British colonies, I took along my socialist convictions, but often had to overcome a squeamish or nervous reluctance to go into the bazaar, so to speak. As recently as 1993, when I set off on a long tour of Africa for my magazine, not one person in Washington failed to wish me luck in darkest Africa, the heart of darkness, the dark continent. As you'll find when you go to Africa, the first thing you notice is the dazzling light. In one way, travelling has narrowed my mind. What I have discovered is something very ordinary and unexciting, which is that humans are the same everywhere, and that the degree of variation between members of our species is very slight. This is, of course, an encouraging finding. It helps arm you against news programmes back home that show seething or abject masses of either fanatical or torpid people. In another way, it is a depressing finding. The sorts of things that make people quarrel and make them stupid are the same everywhere. The two worst things, as one can work out without leaving home, are racism and religion. When allied, these two approximate to what I imagine fascism must have felt like. Freud was brilliantly right when he wrote about the narcissism of the small difference. Distinctions that seem trivial to the visitor are the obsessive concern of the local and the provincial minds. You can, if you spend enough time there, learn to guess by instinct who is Protestant and who is Catholic in Belfast, or who is Tamil and who is Sinhalese in Sri Lanka. And when you hear the bigots talk about the other, it's always in the same tones as their colonial bosses used to employ to talk about them. Dirty, prone to crime, lazy, very untrustworthy with women, and, this is especially toxic, inclined to breed rapidly. In Cyprus, a place I know and love, almost all communication between the two sides is stalled and inhibited by military occupation and partition. But there are certain areas of Greek-Turkish cooperation that transcend the local apartheid. One is the sewage system in the divided capital city, because sewage knows no boundaries. The other is a regional sickle-cell blood malady called thalassemia, which affects both communities. I was talking one day to a Greek-Cypriot physician who was engaged in joint research with Turkish colleagues on this shared disorder. He said to me that it was a funny thing, but if you looked at a blood sample, you couldn't tell who was Turkish and who was Greek. I wanted to ask him whether, before he became a medical man, he had thought that the two nationalities were fashioned from discrepant genetic material. We still inhabit the prehistory of our race, and have not caught up with the immense discoveries about our own nature and about the nature of the universe. The unspooling of the skein of the genome has effectively abolished racism and creationism, and the amazing findings of Hubble and Hawking have allowed us to guess at the origins of the cosmos. But how much more addictive is the familiar old garbage about tribe and nation and faith? I make a minor specialism out of the study of partition, one of the legacies of the British Empire, by the way, though not exclusively to be blamed on it. And I have crossed most of the frontiers that freeze stupidity and hatred in place and time. The Ledra Palace Hotel checkpoint in Nicosia, the Allenby Bridge across the Jordan, the demilitarized zone at Panmunjom in Korea, uncrossable still, though I have viewed it from both sides, the Attari border post that cuts the Grand Trunk Road between Amritsar and Lahore and is the only land crossing between India and Pakistan, the Hill of Shouts, across which divided villages can communicate on the Golan Heights, which I've also seen from both sides, the checkpoints that sprang up around multicultural Bosnia and threatened to choke it, the customs post separating Gaza from the road to Jerusalem. I've stood in the sun or the rain and been searched or asked for bribes by surly guards, or watched pathetic supplicants be humiliated at all of these. Some other barriers, like Checkpoint Charlie in Berlin, or the British Army's bunker between Derry and Donegal, or the frontier separating Hong Kong and Macau from China, have collapsed or partly evaporated, and are just marks in my passport. The other ones will all collapse or dissolve one day, too. But the waste of life and energy that has been involved in maintaining them, and the sheer baseness of the resulting mentality. In some ways I feel sorry for racists and for religious fanatics, because they so much miss the point of being human and deserve a sort of pity. But then I harden my heart and decide to hate them all the more because of the misery they inflict and because of the contemptible excuses they advance for doing so. It especially annoys me when racists are accused of discrimination. The ability to discriminate is a precious faculty. By judging all members of one race to be the same, the racist precisely shows himself incapable of discrimination. To be opposed to racism in the post-genome universe is to be opposed to the concept. This realization lags well behind the reality. Pseudo-scientists who work on supposed proofs of correlation between IQ and race are now rightly criticized because of the opacity and arbitrariness of the definition of intelligence, let alone of its alleged and protean quotient. But they are surely much more vulnerable in their assumption that a person's race can be defined with any exactitude. As I write this, my morning's New York Times has a solemn story about a new attorney general who once accepted an honorary degree from a southern university that prohibits interracial dating. Some say this university is retrograde, others, more lenient, point out that it now permits interracial dating with parental permission. My quarrel would be with anyone employing the term interracial to describe a boy-girl encounter between any two humans, or a boy-boy, or girl-girl one, if it comes to that, which it most certainly will. For years, when I went to renew my annual pass at the United States Senate, I was made to fill in two forms. The first asked me for my biographical details, and the second stipulated that I had signed the former under penalty of perjury. I was grateful for the latter form, because when asked to state my race, I always put human in the required box. This led to a yearly row. Put white, I was once told by an African-American clerk, I might add. I explained that white was not even a color, let alone a race. I also drew his attention to the perjury provision that obliged me to state only the truth. Put Caucasian, I was told on another occasion. I said that I had no connection with the Caucasus and no belief in the outmoded ethnology that had produced the category. So it went on until one year there was no race space on the form. I'd like to claim credit for this, though I probably can't. I offer you the story, also, as part of my recommendation that one acts bloody-minded as often as the odds are favourable, and even sometimes when they are not. It's good exercise. I don't seem to have said enough about the compensating or positive element of exposure to travel. Just as you discover that stupidity and cruelty are the same everywhere, you find that the essential elements of humanism are the same everywhere, too. Punjabis in Amritsar and Lahore are equally welcoming and open-minded, even though partition means the amputation of Punjab as well as of the subcontinent. There are a heartening number of atheists and agnostics in the six counties of Northern Ireland, even though Ulster as well as Ireland has been divided. Most important of all, the instinct for justice and for liberty is just as much innate in us as are the promptings of tribalism and sexual xenophobia and superstition. People know when they are being lied to. They know when their rulers are absurd. They know they do not love their chains. Every time a Bastille falls, one is always pleasantly surprised by how many sane and decent people were there all along. There's an old argument about whether full bellies or empty bellies lead to contentment or revolt. It's an argument not worth having. The crucial organ is the mind, not the gut. People assert themselves out of an unquenchable sense of dignity. I have a Somali friend who, during the Western intervention in her unhappy country in 1992, became a sort of clearinghouse for information on human rights. At one point, a group of Belgian soldiers lost their heads and fired into a Somali crowd, killing a number of civilians. At once, Rakia's switchboard lit up, with every Belgian news desk calling her at once. Alas, these correspondents and editors only wished to know one thing. Were the Belgian soldiers Flemish or Walloon? To this paltry inquiry she replied, I suspect not without relish, that her organisation took no position on tribal rivalries in Belgium. This recollection reminds me that I owe you a letter on the importance of humour. P.S. Since this often seems to come up in discussions of the radical style, I'll mention one other gleaning from my voyages. Beware of identity politics. I'll rephrase that. Have nothing to do with identity politics. I remember very well the first time I heard the saying, the personal is political. It began as a sort of reaction to the defeats and downturns that followed 1968, a consolation prize, as you might say, for people who had missed that year. I knew in my bones that a truly bad idea had entered the discourse. Nor was I wrong. People began to stand up at meetings and orate about how they felt, not about what or how they thought, and about who they were rather than what, if anything, they had done or stood for. It became the replication in even less interesting form of the narcissism of the small difference, because each identity group begat its subgroups and specificities. This tendency has often been satirized, the overweight caucus of the Cherokee transgender disabled lesbian faction demands a hearing on its needs, but never satirized enough. You have to have seen it really happen. From a way of being radical, it very swiftly became a way of being reactionary. The Clarence Thomas hearings demonstrated this to all but the most dense and boring and selfish. But then it was the dense and boring and selfish who had always seen identity politics as their big chance. Anyway, what you swiftly realize if you peek over the wall of your own immediate neighborhood or environment and travel beyond it is, first, that we have a huge surplus of people who wouldn't change anything about the way they were born or the group they were born into, but second, that humanity and the idea of change is best represented by those who have the wit not to think, or, should I say, feel in this way. Chapter 16. Very well, I did promise to take my life in my hands and write about humour. Start with the word wit, which, as I used it above, means native intelligence or savvy. When we say that someone lives by his wits, we don't mean that he makes an income from stand-up comedy, and when we call someone a half-wit, we don't suggest that that person lacks a funny side. But there is a relationship between intelligence and humour, and though it's very unwise to try and describe it, this is what I propose to attempt now. A good place to start is with my friend Martin Amis, whose whole work is a vivid, lasting illustration of comic brilliance allied to high intelligence. In his memoir, Experience, he revenges himself upon some dolt or other, describing him as humourless and adding that by calling him humourless, he means very deliberately to impugn his sense of seriousness. Radicalism is humanism, or it is nothing. The proper study of mankind is man, and the ability to laugh is one of the faculties that defines the human and distinguishes the species from other animals. With the other higher mammals, which I do not in the least wish to insult, there may be high levels of playfulness and even some practical jokes, but no irony. An individual deficient in the sense of humour represents more of a challenge to our idea of the human than a person of subnormal intelligence. We fear the psychopathic and the reptilian when we meet characters like Anthony Powell's Widmerpool. Laughter can be the most unpleasant sound. It's an essential element in mob conduct and is part of the background noise of taunting and jeering at lynchings and executions. Very often, crowds or audiences will laugh complicitly or slavishly just to show they see the joke and are all together. The worst case here is the unfunny racist joke, requiring the least effort to trigger a laugh response. But there are also consensus comedies so awful that they require the post-Pavlovian imposition of a dubbed-in laugh track. It's therefore not true to say, as some optimists do, that humour is essentially subversive. It can be an appeal to the familiar and the clichéd, a source of reassurance through shared hilarity. The Reader's Digest used to run, perhaps still does run, an excruciating monthly feature with the writhe-making heading, Laughter, the Best Medicine. That would make it reactionary almost by definition, because the sophisticated element in humour is exactly its capacity to shock or to surprise or to occur unintentionally. Freud thought this was worthy of study in his Wit and its Relation to the Unconscious, and in his Dream Works, the husband who announces to his wife, "If one of us dies, I'm moving to Paris." It is told of Freud that when he was trapped in Vienna by the Anschluss, he asked the Nazis for a safe conduct to leave. They granted this on condition that he signed a statement saying that he had been well treated. He asked for permission to add an extra sentence and to their delighted surprise wrote, "I can thoroughly recommend the Gestapo to anybody." Professor Frederick Cruz assures me, alas, that this never happened. Had it done so, however, it would have formed part of the record of humour as a resource against the stony, unsmiling face of repressive authority, to say nothing of implacable fate. Everyone has their best example of jokes mocking the old regimes of Eastern Europe. Milan Kundera wrote a whole novel called The Joke about the trouble that could ensue from making the wrong crack at the wrong time, and then, arguably the worst part, having to explain or justify it. I have even heard some good, bitter jokes from the early stages of the Hitler and Stalin nightmares, though there isn't any Shoah or Gulag humour as such. There is, however, a humour based on ironic Jewish fatalism that goes back through millennia of shrugging and can be traced, as I mentioned in another context, from the exaggerated care with which Maimonides says that, though the Messiah is to be expected, he may tarry. Irony, says Czesław Miłosz in his poem Not This Way, is the glory of slaves. The sharp aside and the witty nuance are the consolation of the losers, and are the one thing that pomp and power can do nothing about. The literal mind is baffled by the ironic one, demanding explanations that only intensify the joke. A vintage example, and one that really did occur, is that of P.G. Woodhouse, captured by accident during the German invasion of France in 1940. Joseph Goebbels's propaganda bureaucrats asked him to broadcast on Berlin radio, which he incautiously agreed to do, and his first transmission